Pacifica Radio's special broadcast, Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. This show is presented by Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy and the Pacifica COVID Task Force. Stay with us.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica. The struggle of Black workers and their history in the United States is critical. Today, the battle of the Bessemer, Alabama Amazon workers, 80% of whom are Black, is part of this history. Bessemer, in fact, has a long history of union organizing and struggle. Saladin Muhammad was formerly an international organizer with the UE and is now one of the leaders of the Southern Workers' Assembly, which has launched a national day of action on February 20th of this month for the Bessemer Amazon workers. We spoke to him about this history and the struggle as well in labor.
I'm Saladin Muhammad. I'm with the Southern Workers Assembly. I'm actually a retired international rep from the UE. The Southern Workers Assembly has made the call for a national day of action, partly coming off of our Save Jobs, Save Lives campaign, which has been the campaign around the pandemic and organizing, you know, for safety and other related issues in dealing with the pandemic. You know, we really see this Bessemer campaign as a strategic campaign, one, because it's a part of a major U.S. and global corporation. It's in the state of Alabama, which has a high concentration of industries centered around the auto industry, assembly and parts and tires and other components of the auto industry, which is a major U.S. industry still at this point. So we see it as a strategic campaign for what it's possibly able to do in the South. The other aspect of it is that this solidarity network, particularly with organizing in the South, has been a missing link in the U.S. National labor movement. In fact, the national labor movement has been lacking a real component, a regional component that's organizing in the South, which has always been the Achilles heel of the labor movement. So we see the Day of Action as helping to build a solidarity network with follow-up that begins to be possibly an infrastructure for as part of an ongoing movement to organize labor in the South. Bessemer, as a city, is about 85% Black workers, Black people, and probably the majority being Black workers. And the plant has more than 70% of Black workers. So this struggle that has oftentimes been associated with Black Lives Matter can go deeper in dealing with the question of systemic racism and linking the question of racist or what many of us call national oppression to the super exploitation of workers in the South and especially of Black workers. So we think it's very, very important in helping to build this network and hopefully helping to train new rank and file activists and solidarity supporters following this campaign to really be more intentional and more conscious, a part of a movement to organize labor in the South. We're saying essentially is Day of Action is certainly aimed at being an inspiration and a motivation for winning the union a vote, but we want to emphasize that it's very, very important to maintain rank and file organization regardless of the outcome of the vote, because it is this organization connected to a solidarity network that's important for building the kind of movement to deal with the challenges both of corporate and government power that organizing labor faces organizing in the South.
The struggle to organize the South is been going on for many, many decades, and during the 30s there were strikes which were very important. Why has the AFL-CIO, the national unions, refused to give major resources to organizing in the South, since it's a center where union busting companies have moved plants, auto plants, and industry to get away from unions in the North, in the Midwest.
It seems like the old view of not wanting to deal with the issue of racism coming around Operation Dixie and the like, you know, by most of the unions, that some of that thinking, I think, is still present. It's real clear from all of the dynamics that we've been seeing over the past year, including the attempted seizure of the Capitol, that this question of systemic racism is part of the crisis that's being intensified by the capitalist or the economic crisis. And so we say in the Southern Workers Assembly and that we have to deal with that question, that if we don't deal with that question, that's going to be the question that's going to continuously keep, you know, the South from really, really being organized and building, you know, a movement. In 2012, when the Southern Workers Assembly was founded, it was founded during the National Democratic Convention, the Obama Convention, second one, I guess. And the AFL had pledged to boycott that convention because it was held in North Carolina, and in particular Charlotte, North Carolina, a state that had the worst right-to-work law, along with Virginia, of any other law in the country. It made it illegal to bargain. Not just, you know, you did not, but illegal to bargain. And local governments and others were threatened with even losing some state resources if they dared to bargain, you know. So we were expecting, or some were expecting, that there will be more of an expression of this boycott that would take place at the 2012 convention. The North Carolina Public Service Workers Union, UE 150, and Black Workers for Justice, endorsed by ILA Local 1422 out of Charleston, the RWDSU workers out of Smithfield, and a number of other local unions in North Carolina and in the South came together to found the Southern Workers Assembly. Our view was that workers needed to come together to launch a campaign to fight against right to work and to fight to build rank-and-file organizations in the workplace, not necessarily dependent on trying to win a labor war vote, although that was not excluded, you know, from the organizing approach, but really to build a social movement that were challenging employer policies, government policies, and bringing a sense of power to workers through organization and forms of direct action. And that's how we were formed in 2012, around that. Different from the AFL, we were part of what was called a march on Wall Street South, because banks like Wells Fargo are located in Charlotte and Winston-Salem, and these are global banks. And so we were trying to show the role that the South was now playing in not only in the U.S. national, but the global economy, because there's millions in foreign direct investments in the South, from France, from Germany, from the U.K., in the auto industry, and in other industries in the South.
And the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, what effect has that had on workers in the South, and particularly Black workers, immigrant workers, and has that really incited or encouraged workers to stand up for their health and safety as a matter of life and death?
Yes, it has. When the Southern Workers Assembly formed the Safe Jobs, Safe Saves Lives campaign, we organized a series of webinars. In fact, did a pamphlet on the meatpacking industry, showing, you know, the impacts of COVID on these workers and some of the actions that they were taking. We have that probably a couple hundred copies of those left here. We had a webinar on the transit workers. These were workers from the MARTA, the transportation system in Atlanta, bus drivers in Birmingham, bus drivers in Mobile, transit workers in North Carolina. I had one on teachers, particularly all in the southern region in the main. So, you know, we were able to hear from them in terms of the impacts and some actions that were taken. And some of these workers were not unionized workers, particularly in Texas, that were dealing with meat packers, et cetera. But they felt that being linked to others who were having these experiences gave them some sense of confidence and possibly some vision of being able to struggle when the lack of a real labor movement in the South has prevented those kind of connections, has not helped workers to really understand themselves as a part of a powerful class, you know. And so these struggles which are being caused by national problems that are being caused by national corporations or are reinforced by state and national government policies, unfortunately, have still not been responded to as national or regional struggles. And so, you know, this is what we've been trying to do to make that connection and to deal with that education about the system that workers are up against. But yeah, they're fighting back, and they're finding ways to fight back. In New Orleans, for example, many of the hospitality workers, some who were working, you know, in the casinos, some who were working in terms of some of the Uber drivers, and many, you know, who work in the nightclubs and the bars and those kind of things, have formed, you know, a hospitality workers organization and have taken action, held demonstrations and the like. And so, you know, we see that there's some possibility. And I'm saying possibility, you know, because, you know, we're always confronted with the question of resources, some possibilities of beginning to bring some of the sectors and industries together who, unfortunately, are still fragmented and separated, one, because either the lack of organization, you know, or a business unionism. In that regard. So this is why we think that the Bessemer struggle is so very important. How we educate about the meaning of this struggle, how we educate about the very emergence of the struggle, and why workers chose unionization as a method to be able to build some power to fight a big corporation is going to be important, you know, of how that education takes place. And this is the first real campaign, even though Amazon is throughout the country and has had, you know, struggles and walkouts and strikes in other parts of the country. But this is the first actual major union campaign that's taken place.
Amazon thought that they wouldn't have to deal with the black workers in Bessemer, that they could treat them the way they wanted without them organizing a union. You think Amazon and the capitalists are shocked about this development?
Yeah, I think so. On the one hand, you know, the Democratic Party, for example, has, in the Biden administration, has recruited a number of black and people of color into the administration, into the cabinet. How much Amazon and the Democratic Party has been able to draw on elements who have been fighting for blacks to be in administration to speak out against unionization, I don't know that they've been very successful in doing that. We still have, I think it's March 29th, when all of the votes are supposed to be counted, you know, so there's still a little time to try to continue to build against that kind of effort, but it hasn't yet shown itself, and it's quite possible so for them to have some kind of influence in that direction. But yes, I think it probably, I think the corporations were shocked. I mean, there's always a underestimation of the potential of the black working class, and that underestimation largely takes place when sections of the black working class are not part of a larger movement like the civil rights movement, the black power movement that really brought forward some elements of power of the black masses. And so a campaign, you know, in a town, and a singular campaign and not a campaign, you know, of many Amazon locations, et cetera, I think, yes, they were shocked, probably shocked at that. This is one of the reasons why this day of action and this effort to try to build solidarity, not only solidarity, but to lift up a movement that sees the Bessemer campaign as creating a climate that can contribute to a long-term organizing strategy. And so, yes, I think they were shocked.
And the fascists and racists, including the mob that tried to that did try an attempted coup and an insurrection, they have historically tried to pit black workers against white workers, and some of them would like to bring back the Confederacy. This struggle now of unionization, this mass movement that you're talking about, could lead to a mass workers movement in the United States, which we haven't seen since the 1930s, 1940s. Also, that raises the question of a labor party, an actual workers' party in the United States. Do you think a mass workers movement in the United States has the potential of leading to a political development in the working class?
I think so. I mean, I think that workers are starting to see major contradictions in both of the corporate-dominated parties, are really seeing it. And they're not seeing any major change in foreign policies, and even the reforms, $15 by 2025, you know, and those kinds of things. Workers are starting to see that they can't depend on either of these parties. Obviously, I think, you know, the Trump and the neo-fascists, what that actually meant for black people, you know, had black people, you know, in our thinking to vote Trump out, you know, which meant electing Biden, but not because he was any kind of savior, but he was seen as a way to get Trump regime out. But I do think that as a region, you know, we're starting to see, even though we're seeing automation, you know, technology start to take over some major industries, you know, it hasn't totally eliminated the working class, as some people would argue. But what was, during the 1930s, the core industries like steel and meatpacking and auto, you're seeing a major shift, a major regional shift in those industries, and possibly a new core industries. I mean, like Amazon, in terms of these big warehouses, even with tech with robots, in order for them to deal with just-in-time parts, they have to, you know, store them in a warehouse somewhere. So the distribution chain of the warehouses have become now like a new core industry in this era. And so, you know, how do we educate about what this industry means to the overall economic system, you know, and what this campaign means to it, and some of the issues that these workers, these majority of black workers, you know, are dealing with, you know, address the question of systemic racism and how that's much more part of the economy than many people know and understand, you know. So, yes, I think the question of Labor Party, now, again, this was another time, you know, but this question of forming independent parties or breakaway parties or those kind of things, you know, I think the Downs County Freedom Organization in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and some other parties throughout the South point, you know, to the fact that political formation is real possible. And if we have a labor movement in the South, then I think the possibility of a labor and a community based party is really possible. I think at this stage of the economic crisis and the role that the South continues to play, I think it's very possible to see aspects of that development, whether they take the form of county and state organizations. I think it's still possible to see that.
And what can the American working class do to support this action on February the 20th? How can American workers, trade unionists, and working people who support the struggle of the Amazon workers to organize a union, what action can they take on the 20th to let the people and, you know, the workers in know in Bessemer, but also all American workers, that we have a right to have unions and decent lives and decent conditions against these billionaire corporations run by people who could care less whether workers live or die on the job?
Well, right now we've been calling for the National Day of Action. This is information pickets, leafleting, Amazon locations, interacting with the workers, making contact with those workers, and building other labor and community support around them. In terms of what Amazon might do to try to break the union or those kinds of things, will probably have a lot to do with what kind of action might be called for around the country. There are various groupings that are forming in Amazon, the Amazonians United, and a couple other groups, you know, that connect to Amazon. And I think it just depends, you know, if they do a mass firing or, you know, or a significant firing or something of that nature, you know, between now and the 29th, it could provoke some stronger actions than the picketing and the solidarity expression around the country.
And what can people do to get in touch with your organization and to find out how they can support your efforts for a National Day of Action for the Amazon Bessemer workers?
The SouthernWorkersAssembly.org can go on to that and notify us that they want to, that they've identified an Amazon site that they're prepared to groups out to, and we can send them a flyer that could be used while they're out there. People can make their own sign and that kind of thing. There's some people who are going out to Whole Foods locations in their areas because Amazon here also, I think, the owner of Whole Foods. But we've been focusing on that. So if they contact SouthernWorker.org, there's information on our website that can give people directions of how they can support.
We want justice, got to have justice. 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 For many years, some worked as slaves, sun up, sundown, and even Sundays. Till this wealthy nation took the work from us. The services rendered, reparations, what we needed.
We want justice, got to have justice, power to the people.
All we needed.
We want justice, got to have justice, power to the
people. What we needed.
We want justice, got to have justice, power to the people.
This song was by The Fruits of Labor.
You're listening to Black History in the Making, Reclaiming Our Past, Redefining Our Future. This show is presented by Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy and the Pacifica COVID Task Force.
Amazon workers are fed up with their conditions and treatment, especially in the middle of a pandemic. In August, San Leandro Amazon workers helped shut down the warehouse for 4 hours. John Hopkins and Adrian Williams talked about the conditions at Amazon.
Here's the thing, and this is the reason why I am making this point, is because Amazon claims to have an open door policy, but I see my manager walking around in there, but he won't take this piece of paper from me. I'm calling on them to actually shut down this facility for 2 weeks to prove that they actually do care about Black and Latinx lives, because I don't believe them. Because they can't even come out and collect a piece of paper from me and show me that amount of respect. So I don't believe them. I don't believe that Amazon believes that Black lives matter. This is the petition that we started on coworker.org. I've turned it into a QR code, so all that Mahmood has to do is scan this and he'll have a PDF. He doesn't even have to take it from me in my hands. He can just grab his phone, scan it, and he'll have a PDF of all the people who have signed our petition calling on Amazon to shut this facility down for 2 weeks to prove that they actually do care about Black and Latinx lives. In the Bay Area, we are experiencing a surge of coronavirus cases. And this facility does not do a good job of enforcing social distancing. I filed a complaint last week with OSHA because I was suspended for 2 weeks, supposedly about a social distancing violation. But every single night when I come into work, I see people within a couple feet of each other. And I never see a manager actually do anything about it. So I don't believe that they actually care about Black and Latinx lives. And so I'm asking them to shut down the facility, and several of my coworkers as well, and many fine people who understand that it is crucial to shut this facility down for deep cleaning and pay everybody during that time so that they can take care of their families. Because Jeff Bezos made $13 billion in a single day, and they can't even give us $2 of hazard pay or come out and take this flyer from me. They don't even have to touch it. They can scan it from 6 feet away. From a social distance, they can scan this. And Mahmood, my manager, who claims that he has an open door policy, he can't even come out and show me that much respect. I brought all these people out here to show their support and say, hey, John, I see that this is important to you. I don't believe they believe that Black Lives Matter. When they tell the Whole Foods workers, who are also the subsidiary of Amazon, that they can't wear a mask like mine that expresses the very uncontroversial sentiment that Black Lives Matter. And so we have another petition calling on Jeff Bezos to say the words. I want to see a video of Jeff Bezos saying Black Lives Matter, because if he believes it, he should not tell his employees that it's a controversial statement. And he should not allow any of his workers, his underlings, to do that either.
I can tell you that before COVID, I used to wear this little Samsung watch because I like to count my steps just out of curiosity. And I averaged between 56 and 6,600 steps per day. And when I came back on June 11th, during, you know, COVID, I was averaging between 10,000 and 11,000 steps per day, and the expectation is that you still did it within the same amount of time, and you got paid nothing extra, and, you know, hazard pay, you got that bonus on 1 month, but we've been working throughout the pandemic for 5 months. I mean, I'm worried about a ton of things. I'm worried about the focus being taken off of this problem the minute it's not a hot story anymore, and more deaths occurring, and it not being something that's in the media attention, so it's like it doesn't exist, even though it's very apparent to us. It exists to us because we have to face it every day. I'm afraid of a government that cares more about their own ratings and their own votes, so they'd rather us not have testing because they think it means that they'll get voted in, and therefore they'd rather us die than them have adequate testing, that's terrifying to somebody who has to face the public every day. I work at the Richmond warehouse, or worked, I quit last week. I was told at my warehouse that three drivers came up positive and that Amazon told my DSP boss not to tell us. I luckily work for a boss that cares about his group, and so he did inform our group, but not every DSP boss is the same. And so that's terrifying.
On Juneteenth of last year, the International Longshore and Warehouseman Union in the Bay Area shut down the docks and led a march of over 20,000 workers and community members through Oakland. It was the largest workers' action on Juneteenth in the United States. One of the key organizers of that action is Clarence Thomas, who is a retired member of ILWU Local 10. He talked to us about the history of the ILWU and the fight against racism, not only outside the labor movement, but inside the labor movement. He also talked about the fight for rank-and-file control and against business unionism. Now to his talk.
Well, one of the things, Steve, that we cannot ignore is to learn from history and the fact that the segregationists, who we'll call the Dixiecrats, who were against African-American workers being allowed to participate in Social Security if they worked in an agrarian situation or if they were domestic workers, or Dixiecrats telling Roosevelt that if, quote, niggas were to have national health care, that they don't want it, that they don't want it if black people are going to have it too. This deal cut to basically undermine the organizing of workers in the South. These things have, you know, created the environment of where we are right now. And we have to look at these historical occurrences and understand them and realize that as of this day, because I just thought about how in 2016, well, I think it was in 2016, we were in Canton, Mississippi, where Nissan workers were attempting to have a vote in Canton around the issue of having a union, and how many of the elder black workers there and whites were afraid that if unionization were to occur, that they would lose their jobs. Of course, the Republicans had, you know, threatened all kind of, are you going to, you're going to lose subsidies, tax subsidies, there's all kind of things that's going to happen that can mean that you can lose your job if you vote for a union. The United Auto Workers were attempting to do this. Danny Glover was there. I was there along with Bernie Sanders and others, and they had about 5,000 people that showed up for a rally. The fear of unionization, which is directly connected with white supremacy, systemic racism, it's all connected. And when you see these municipalities just giving these corporations whatever they want, you basically are buying jobs. You know, we're going to give you billions of dollars of tax cuts if you come to Mississippi or North Carolina to set up an auto plant, whether or not it's Mercedes, BMW. And so to see these workers at Amazon doing this is very, very historic. And coming from the ILWU, I'm a third generation longshore worker. My grandfather started in the waterfront in 1944, along with so many blacks who came from the Gulf States and from the South to go to work in the shipyards here on the West Coast and meatpacking plants in the Midwest and various other places. You know, we can't help but be reminded of what having a union job meant to African Americans. It meant the ability to make a living wage. It meant dignity on the job. And for those who started working on the waterfront, many of whom came straight off the cotton fields, and to be able to go to work where if the boss fired you, you were just fired for the day. And there was a grievance machinery where you could challenge the firing. And to think that in 1934, during the height of the Depression, with widespread segregation and white supremacy reigning in the trade union movement, to have a man like Harry Bridges and men like Henry Schmidt from Local 10, who realized that they could not win the West Coast strike of 1934 on the waterfront without the support of black workers, because historically black workers have been exploited and used as scab labor to break strikes. And to have the consciousness to say, the only way we're going to win this is to have the support of the black community. And I say that Bridges and Henry Schmidt and the other leftists and radicals and Marxist-Leninists of the Local 10, who were still a part of the ILA at that time, they recognized in 1934 that Black Lives Matter. It was truly a revolutionary moment. And the fact that they went to the churches with the assistance of people like C.L. Dellums, who was a vice president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and the uncle of Congressman and former Mayor Ron Dellums, who was very instrumental in making that happen. That was indeed a historical moment. And it's one that really has not been underscored to the degree that it should. It was something that was a landmark action on the part of the labor movement, and one of the things that made Bridges such an extraordinary trade union leader. But one has to be able to confront the issue of race and racism. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois talked about the wages of whiteness. I mean, essentially the idea that white workers believe that because they are not Black, okay, that they have achieved a certain amount of membership and protection in the society, even though they are exploited and degraded to the degree that they are by not having a union. And so it's time that we confront this and take it on. I think that what's going on right now with the Southern Workers National Mobilization call for February the 20th is absolutely critical. When we organized the Million Worker March in 2004, we recognized at that time that there were something like 12% of the workers belonged to a union. And most of that membership really involved people who work for public sector unions, you know, not industrial unions. And so the majority of the workers in the United States don't belong to a union. So you either have workers that they're either unionized or they're not. So the call for this action on the part, in particular, the Southern Workers Assembly, of which I've had the opportunity to work with them in the past, specifically with Saladin Muhammad, who was very instrumental in organizing for the Million Worker March in the South. This is indeed a momentous occasion to see this kind of action being taken, especially when we recognize that Amazon, I believe that's the number one employer in the country now. It's the biggest corporation in America and growing fast. Billionaires who do not care anything at all about their workers, who don't care about whether or not they live or die. And that is the reason that they have been denied PPEs, you know, personal protective equipment. That is one of the reasons why COVID-19 runs rampant through our communities. You're in a situation where you either come to work or you die. We don't care, you know. And so what I find very difficult to understand is why the trade union movement is not supporting these workers. Well, one of the reasons why they're not supporting these workers has a great deal to do, you know, with the systemic racism that is a part of the trade union movement. It's readily there. I'd like to call attention very quickly. In 2016, right before the presidential election, Bob McElrath, who was the president of the ILWU, wrote in his column that the union people didn't have any choice but to vote for Hillary Clinton. I found his remarks very instructive because he went on to say that we can't vote for Donald Trump. But he said, I have friends who find Trump very appealing. And he said that the reason why is that folks thought that he was tough and competent. But one of the things that he did not mention was how racist Trump was, how xenophobic he was, Islamophobic, and all of the rest. And I found that very telling because, you know, the reasons why trade union leaders find it so difficult to confront white supremacy inside and outside of the trade union movement, because many of the people who are in positions of leadership are white males themselves. I think that there's a blind spot. There's a blind spot that many, many whites have when it comes to the issue of systemic racism, because they benefit from that. And they are not confronted with the reality of what it means to be the most oppressed and exploited based upon the color of your skin. Simply that alone. And so this whole idea of whiteness, which especially the white working class, they feel that they're a part of some other kind of working class. As a matter of fact, most of them buy into the idea that they're not working class at all, that they're middle class. We hear that a lot. Oh, I'm middle class. And they say that a lot of it is very abstract, because we know that because you make a certain amount of dollars in this country doesn't necessarily make you middle class. So we really find out about class and these false notions. I call it false consciousness. And it must be confronted right now. The trade union movement in many instances is influenced by business unionism. They believe in collaboration with the bosses. They see that the bosses and the union are somehow our partners. You know what I'm saying? So this is the false notion. So when that happens, the union leaders begin to act like union bosses. They're much more comfortable on the golf course with the bosses than they are actually facing their own rank and file. Now, you know, the ILWU is unlike a lot of other unions in terms of how much we pay our international leaders. You got some unions that pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to those individuals, and they have private jets. And I remember Leo Robinson once saying at a Million Worker March meeting that there should be a motion made by rank and filers in various unions that if workers take a pay cut, that the leadership should take a commensurate one, because that doesn't happen right now. So the attitude of the leadership is such that they see themselves as being bosses. They see themselves in partnership with the employer. And just to call your attention to something that happened in the, you know, just 4 years ago, if you remember, Donald Trump invited some trade union leaders to come to the White House. I think there were people from the building trades that showed up. I'm not sure if it was the Teamsters or not. But ostensibly, they went there to see if Trump would support the Davis-Bacon Act. They thought he was going to do infrastructure projects, right? So they were saying things like, Trump's a builder, we're builders. Now, you know damn well Trump ain't no damn builder, but this is the bullshit that they were saying. So they go there. Trump, it's a dog and pony show. You know, Trump takes photographs with him. He doesn't keep his commitments to discuss these things. And when they left the room, they got no guarantee that Trump was going to support Davis-Bacon. I mean, you know, these guys, but listen, they're all white. There might've been one black in the room maybe. And you take the building trades for an example, they've got a tremendous density in terms of members, right? But let's look at their history of discriminating and keeping black people out of the union. You know what I'm saying? You know, so there's so many examples of how this white supremacy, systemic racism is basically just eating away at the trade union movement. And this is the reason why you see the Southern Workers Assembly and the emergence of the Million Worker March and all these other groupings of black trade unionists that have emerged over a century, that have taken on the responsibility of not only being advocating for trade unions, but at the same time, calling out white supremacy and discrimination. And the folks who have been in the vanguard of that have been African-American trade unionists. And so I think that we're witnessing that right now with what's going on with these Amazon workers in the South. I just hope that right now, that black workers in particular understand that we're in a very critical period right now with all the forces that are at play, with the emergence of the three percenters, the oath keepers, all of these various militias and right-wing and racist forces that are coming together. And so it's absolutely critical that black workers step out there and start to talk about the crucial things that are necessary, not only for them, but for all workers who work for Amazon. The only way we're going to be able to confront this white supremacy, we're going to have to be able to provide a working class perspective. That does not mean that we don't understand what the power of racism and what it means to us, but we have to understand that racism is a fundamental aspect of capitalism. It's fundamental to it. They go together like a hand in glove. And so we have to be very strategic in how we approach this. So we have an obligation to reach out and to show leadership to all workers, Black or white, because if we don't do that, then we know where we're headed. We're headed towards a civil war, you know. And I maintain that Black workers can play a very important role in that. We have been playing a very important role. But the leadership of the trade union movement is very, very reluctant to embrace and support that Black leadership. And we saw that come into play in 2004 when members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 10 decided to put forward a resolution called Support for the Million Worker March. We had to take on not only AFL-CIO and labor officialdom, but we also had to take on the Democratic Party itself. And the reason why we know this is based upon the historical record of our leadership who met at the Kennedy compound right before the Democratic Convention in 2004 in Hyannisport, with Andy Stern and John Sweeney and James Hoffa Jr. and also our own international president, Jim Spinoza. They were all there and they discussed how the Million Worker March was the wrong time for this. It was the wrong time. Actually, they said the same thing about the March on Washington in 1963, although that march did go forward, but they were trying to do all they possibly could to undermine the idea of the Million Worker March. And why was that? Because we were talking about ending the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, national health care, stop the dismantling of public education, a living wage, cutting the military budget, ending these corporate free trade agreements, stopping NAFTA. We wanted to stop Taft-Hartley. If Taft-Hartley goes, then that means labor will have a free hand to be able to mobilize in the South. So here we are, primarily Black workers who take this initiative on their own without the blessing of their international leadership. Our own union did everything they possibly can to make sure that that did not happen, providing not one cent out of our leadership to the Million Worker March movement. They thought that that was going to kill it. They really did. And they had no idea that Brother Leo Robinson, who was a retiree in the ILWU, would do a very revolutionary act and use tens of thousands of his own hard-earned money working as a longshoreman for more than 30 years to help finance and make it possible to make this event happening. This t-shirt that I'm wearing that he designed. They realized when these t-shirts came out that the Million Worker March was going to happen, but that didn't stop them from trying to undermine it right until the very day of the march where they diverted buses away from the Lincoln Memorial. But I think that one of the things that people who will be reading my book that will be coming out hopefully in April, and it's called Mobilizing in Our Own Name, the Million Worker March Movement. I'm hopeful that these workers in the Southern Workers Assembly and other workers across the country will learn some lessons from the Million Worker March. And that is this: we have to be committed. We have to be committed to self-determination. We have to be committed to the right to organize. We have to be committed to changing the dynamics that currently exist right now between workers who don't have a union and who work for companies like Amazon. This is the time. Now's the time to seize the time. Now is not a time to be fearful, because all we have to fear is fear itself. We're already dying. We're already dying. We've seen our family members die. We've seen our youth die from the police. these merciless killings. We have to stand right now. We won't be standing alone, because we could see from the national uprising around the question of systemic racism and white supremacy, with the killing of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and others, that the whole world responded to this. We saw actions taken in Europe. We saw Palestinian brothers and sisters supporting our cause, and in some instances being killed. So this is a universal movement. It's global. All we got to do is to stand. We're in the belly of the beast. So I'm very pleased to know about what's going on February 20th. We need to get behind this. This is a very, very important moment right now for us.
Angela Davis on Juneteenth, 2020, spoke to the ILWU and the 20,000 participants at the rally in March.
Happy Juneteenth, everyone. We are still on the long road to freedom. Whenever the ILWU takes a stand, the world feels the reverberations. A powerful, collective thank you to the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. We remember your stance against the internment of Japanese Americans in the 1940s. We applaud the fact that you stood with Martin Luther King and civil rights activists in the 1960s. We know that you radicalized the struggle against South African apartheid in the 1980s. And we thank you for supporting Mumia Abu-Jamal, for solidarity with the anti-capitalist Occupy movement, and for your resounding no to the racist state of Israel, and for your expressions of solidarity with those who call for justice in Palestine. And thank you especially now for speaking out against the brutal racist murderers of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Rayshard Brooks, and the many others whose lives have been claimed by the structural violence of racism. Thank you for shutting down the ports today on Juneteenth, the day we celebrate the end of slavery, the day we memorialize those who offered us hope for the future, and the day when we renew our commitment to the struggle for freedom. Thank you, ILWU, for shutting down the West Coast ports today. You represent the potential and power of the labor movement. Hopefully, this action will influence other unions to stand up and say no to racism, and yes to abolishing the police as we know them, yes to reimagining the meaning of public safety and security.
This is Black History in the Making, reclaiming our past, redefining our future. The show you just heard was produced in collaboration with the Pacifica COVID Task Force, the production team of COVID Race and Democracy, Pacifica Network stations, and affiliates throughout the country. Our engineer is John Miller. Our production editors are Paulina Fasiliev, Lona Alliance, and Akua Holt, along with our media intern, Akono Kamau. Fahima Sack is our line producer. Steve Zelter and Akua Holt are the executive producers. Our theme music by the godfather of Afrobeat, Fela Anikalapo Kuti, Water No Get Enemy. Special thanks to Knitting Factory Records and Lydia Bazone, interim executive director of the Pacifica Network. Listen to this and other programs online and discover more about COVID, race, and democracy at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thank you for listening.